Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, good afternoon, welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we have the honor and privilege of talking to Mr. Josh Lieberman. He is the owner, CEO of NetSciences Incorporated. Josh, thanks for your time this afternoon, and we welcome having you on today's show.
Well, thanks very much, Robbie. I appreciate that. You set the bar a little high. Honor, privilege. It's just nice to be here.
Well, I consider every guest to be an honor and privilege, but I know you have time out of your schedule. But anyway, so we looked up your bio, LinkedIn, Google. We didn't do a background search or anything like that. No, but you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. It sounds like you've been doing this for like a very, very long time, at least with technology going back to the 1990s, it looks like. Can you please elaborate on some of the highlights of your career?
Sure. So I actually came in kind of sideways into IT security. I worked from 1990 to 95 for various contractors to the Department of Energy. And early on, in terms of IT security, I'm going to put the date of 1993 on there, we started to connect to DARPANET and the Internet, or they were kind of becoming one and the same at that time. I was one of the first people, if not the first folks in my group, to have an email address as well as to have direct access to the Internet. But IT security was basically locking the door to the server room and maybe NATing a private IP block. There wasn't very much to IT security, and my actual job was more along the lines of building digital video capabilities, which 27 years ago meant 4 or 5 full-length cards to decode video of about CGA quality, so think 16 colors and 256 pixels. It was just these tiny little insets that would be a joke on a phone today, but 27 years ago it was all a thing. I mean, delivering that over a network the next year at 640 by 40 and leaping to VGA was just amazing. But I started to move. I did a lot of physical security stuff. I wrote scenarios and did studying of the various facilities that we physically defended, and I started to marry both physical and IT security on a very rudimentary level. And when I left at the end of 95 from that employment and started NetSciences, I came in with the idea that we were going to really focus on security from day one. Again, that was largely physical. In New Mexico, I think the first ISDN circuit was 96 or 97, 97, although I had done it in 94 for client Phoenix. I had a part-time business on the side from 90 to 95. So I came into it from that angle, and as we developed Internet access and it started to become more of a reality in Albuquerque, it really began to hit in 99 and 2000. I chanced across SonicWall at a trade show. I believe it was Interop, or back then NetWorld it was known as, and immediately seized upon their product line, and I believe we started actually placing firewalls in 2000, which we hope that 20 years later, that's kind of a given everywhere, but it really isn't. We still see many, many businesses, especially in the medical field, oddly, that don't place firewalls. So as I developed a more of a specialty, what I realized is that it's wonderful to be expert at enterprise solutions, and I'd love to be, dealing in nothing but Palo Alto and Okta and network physics and all these guys, but the reality is in our SMB market, and in Albuquerque, 99% of our businesses have less than 100 employees, and somewhere around 90% have less than 10. We're dealing with small business, so I needed to find a way to bring 80% of enterprise-level security into these sites at 10 or 20% of the cost, and that's really been my focus. So I eschew the title of a security expert because I don't see myself that way. I'm more of an expert at wrapping security around folks without actually talking about security or selling them security, but talking and selling them uptime and stability and protection, peace of mind.
Excellent. Now, how did you start your company, NetSciences, and how long has it really been in business?
Well, I guess technically December 26, 1995, it was founded. We did our first sold our first box of software a week later to a law firm in Albuquerque. So that was the beginning of 96. So I usually tell people we started in 96. And that law firm, ironically, is the last place I worked before the Department of Energy. And I had come in to do a transition from mini computers, Wang system, to bring them to PCs, not knowing at the time that I had a short-term tenure at that job. I thought I was the permanent systems manager. So they hired me in April or May of 1990, and I think they thought the project would take 2 or 3 years. It took 2 or 3 months, and then I was out on my own again. So that's how I ultimately got back on my feet. I decided that I was in a lot of debt at that time, $35K and a philosophy and a linguistics degree to show for it. So I decided that I'd go work my way out of debt and then start my own business. Sorry. And that was September of 1990. My belief was that it would take 7 years, and it took a little over five. Once I was out of debt, unfortunately, the desire to continue to work for the government faded away much more quickly than I thought, and I didn't save up 2 years of money. I saved up 2 months of money and started Net Sciences. So that's the long story, and here we are.
Okay. Excellent. Now, Net Sciences, are you pretty much the U.S.-based business, or do you have presence in other countries as well?
We're U.S.-based in terms of delivering services. I have spoken in Europe and in Australia for a few of the vendors in our space. This was going to be a busy year for that, but other things stepped up. So as far as actually doing business, it's entirely limited to the state, to New Mexico, and we've done some business in Texas, Arizona, Colorado, and California, but even now we're about 99% New Mexico. But I do get around, and I have spoken in a couple dozen states and a few countries as well.
Okay, excellent. Now let's kind of do a deep dive into your product and service line. I'm at your website, and it seems like you have like distinct service offerings, like in managed IT services, business continuity, and the virtual CIO. Can you expand a little bit more on all of these, please? And I'm really kind of really interested in the business continuity, because I think we'll be talking more about this here in a few minutes, about the COVID ID. But I know that with the COVID ID 19, I think a lot of business leaders, both cyber and non-cyber, they're starting to realize we should have had a plan in place, because, you know, they had all of a sudden, you know, deploy a remote workforce, you know, very quickly, and it obviously, you know, nobody realized the magnitude of what was going to happen. So it was done in a haphazard fashion. So I think business leaders, you know, they're just realizing that we need to have something in place. But if you can expand a little bit more on that, how you're helping businesses with that as we're starting to reopen up our sports, that'd be great.
Well, sure. One of the things that is most interesting from that standpoint is that business continuity has taken on a greater dimension. When I first wrote that, and when I first started working on the whole concept of business continuity, it was entirely focused on what happens if there's a premise server failure or other premise equipment failure, or maybe secondary internet access. Disaster recovery is another step beyond that, but business continuity really didn't contemplate what happens if you can't be in the building, but the building is still there and your equipment is still there. And as you proliferate, as sites moved more away from premise and into cloud solutions, business continuity became both easier and more difficult, because you have multi-cloud solutions to manage, but they're in the cloud. So where you're connecting from is no longer so challenging. The way I look at business continuity is it's more like we look at disaster recovery now. There are more aspects to this than just getting access to your data. Any good DR plan has to have things like rally points and how to reach your clientele, reach your employees, and how to prioritize business operations and who's critical and in what order, and on and on and on. And I've learned that business continuity carries a lot more of that as well. The good news is that even though we are primarily a premise-based a premise-based clientele, we had very little difficulty transitioning people to work from home, because we had access to a great proxied RDS solution. A lot of us in this industry as MSPs rely upon SSL VPN connectivity, and so do we. But there are some challenges with SSL VPN, especially when it comes to locking down that connection and to protecting against lateral movement within a network. And it can be tricky. And of course, for most of us, SSL VPN is just a wrapper around an RDS or RDP session anyway. So we had recently engaged, Ravi, can I use names here, vendor names?
Sure, go ahead. There you go, ahead.
Okay, we had, in January, we had engaged, or actually the very end of December, with a company known as TrueGrid, and they provide a couple of solutions that we engage with, a proxied RDS solution as well as an encryption management solution that's basically a wrapper around BitLocker that does reporting, key escrow, and other things that we like. Well, the RDS solution timing was incredible. I mean, we were just in the middle of deciding that we were going to go that way in January, and we tested it extensively and started to offer it in February. And right around the 10th of February, which was a big day for me in terms of the timing of my life, I made the decision to just throw this out there. And 1 month later, I think March 11th, I realized, wow, we're going to need this just about everywhere. So we started proliferating that, and we made the decision to give away that product and its setup. Giving it away isn't very expensive or difficult to do. We are able to absorb that. Choosing to give away the setup was generous, if not entirely business-wise, and it cost a lot, but we got it done. It's actually an easy product to set up, but you know, once you get in the hundreds, scaling is a little tough. That was set up, and it really helped a lot. That was a huge business continuity leap forward for us that we didn't have before. But honestly, my whole concept of what constitutes business continuity took a major leap. It was just such a broader topic than I had realized before. Fortunately, we had just the right tool set to handle it, and we'd had enough experience at a much slower pace providing remote access. Things worked out. It was quite good. Now, we also, anybody that does this realizes that part of this is enhanced communications. And enhanced communications are things like a voice over IP phone that people can take home and plug into their network, or nowadays connect to their Wi-Fi. That also includes things like messaging or Teams or Slack or Trello or whatever your particular preferred flavor is. So we'd also migrated folks who had never really thought about using Microsoft Teams because they were happy to shout at each other or walk down the hallway or send emails. We got those people to realize that Teams gives them an extra dimension of functionality. As a matter of fact, collaboration is, I think, probably going to be amongst the silver linings of this as people come back to work or remain in hybrid at work and at home situations, going to realize how important Teams are, and maybe we'll even see people understanding their role in remaining secure as a business improve as well.
Excellent. Now, since you're primarily focused in the New Mexico market, who is your typical customer base that you're trying to target? Is it the SMBs, the larger companies like Fortune 500, or is it perhaps a mix of both? Or in other words, what's your sweet spot?
Sure. Well, I mean, I want to reiterate that New Mexico is a state of small businesses, as are several other very sparsely populated states like Wyoming, Montana, the Dakotas. So here, if you get to a site that has 300 employees, you're above the top 1%. At 100 employees, you're right at the top 100%, and at 50 employees, you're in the top few percent. So there are very few larger businesses, and as a consequence of the mathematics of that, our target is smaller business. I would say that our sweet spot is probably between 20 and 40 users. We have that brings you into a business that typically has the finances to afford professional services, and they've developed some sort of professionalism in how they manage and run their business. The idea of planning and budgeting is not completely alien to them, and they have probably suffered from enough IT difficulties in their time, especially through their growth to that size, that they understand the necessity of having that support. Having said that, we have a 2-user site. I have a 4-user site. I have a 95-user site. The 68-user site, we certainly move around that, but our entire the vast focus of what we do is probably on that 20 to 40 seat range. Now, that actually turns out to be the sweet spot for most MSPs in the United States from my research, and as a matter of fact, nearly all MSPs under $5 million. So you're going to see that that doesn't set us apart. We just might have a slightly smaller pond to fish from. Albuquerque is about 620,000 people. If you draw a 60-mile circle around it, which would include Santa Fe, you can push that to around 900,000, but it's not a very big metropolitan statistical area or MSA. It's a pretty small market.
Okay, excellent. Now, do you have any customer success stories that you'd like to share with us or any client testimonials
Sure.
that you'd like to let our audience?
Oh, of course. And by the way, I did fail to mention that we do focus on professional services and
Okay.
to some extent engineering, CAD, and design. That's declined over the years, all the way back to 2009 or 10, when our economy contracted with the rest of the states. We experienced a drop-off of construction and CAD, and that had been our vertical for a very long time. So nowadays it's much more broadly spread out over professional services in general. So I guess success stories include things like convincing folks 4 weeks before they had a server failure that they needed a very effective snapshot-based business continuity device. We're a data shop, and we had a site like that, my accountant actually, where they lost a server. It's only 4 years old, but they had a corrupt RAID array, and the time would have taken to recover for them in the midst of financial or March tax season would have been terrible for them. So we rolled them over in less than, I think, 40 minutes to their Datto device, and it worked so well for them that even though we built the server and were ready to deliver it within a week, we discovered that they decided to wait a month and let their season finish because it was just close enough to the same kind of performance they were used to. They decided to just keep moving that way. And then, you know, once the season passed, we transitioned it back. We also had a very large call center site that we failed over 8 or 10 servers onto a much larger, more complicated and expensive Datto device, and we rolled them onto that, and they actually ran from that device for several months because there was a huge parts shortage, and the SAN failure that they experienced wasn't resolvable for 11 or 12 weeks. And then we rolled them back. So those are your typical DR type or BC DR type disasters. That's a great example of catching people before they hit the ground. Even better, every now and again, we get to come into a site and make sure that they never have that kind of failure. So we've taken a large number of very small 5, 10, 20 user sites that never had professional IT. And I don't know if it's unique to our market, but more than half the people we meet up to today, and I've kept good statistics for over 10 years, have never had professional ongoing IT support. They really just bring in people when they see flames, not even necessarily when they smell smoke, but once there's fire that they can actually detect, they bring them in. And I think our greatest success is convincing people that that's not a business-friendly, business-wise way to run. And I have brought many, many sites into our fold who have come from nothing but spending $1,000 once or twice a year to spending $1,000 or $2,000 a month and never having another issue. I don't want to go too deeply into this. I feel like I'm bragging, but I will say one other thing. We used to have a counter on our site that showed the number of days since the last day of unplanned downtime. I think you've seen businesses that say 600 days since our last accident or something like that. I had to take it down because I took so much ridicule. The last day a managed site of ours has had an unplanned day of downtime, so obviously we're not counting network transitions, was in November of 1999. So, and I remember it extremely well. It was Thanksgiving week, and we patched a server, and it went poorly, and we didn't have an image to fall back on. That was kind of a tough thing to do back then. And I scrambled for 2 days to bring them up just before Thanksgiving. But that was our last, what I would call, failure, at least one that, you know, outage that lasted more than 4 hours. And that was 20 and a half years ago. So I consider that to be our biggest success story. Yeah, it's a long time. Now, part of that is we don't work with folks that won't do things well. We have kind of a floor of services. People have to clear the bar, so to speak, and that's not a simple bar. You know, they have to have advanced endpoint detection. They have to have a UTM firewall that's fully supported and up to date. They have to have automated patching. They have to have DNS filtering, user training. We throw in dark web alerting with that, and they have to have BCDR appliance and service on site, assuming they have premise server. So that's kind of a high bar to clear. It does serve two purposes. It lets us sleep at night and not answer late calls. We had 4 out of our calls last year. We've had 1 this year. And it unfortunately keeps us from growing quickly because there are a lot of businesses that just don't see the value in that. And if I can't change their mind, we both move on.
Okay, well, now, obviously, there are a lot of cybersecurity vendors, you know, MSPs out there in the marketplace, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 or so. Why should someone come to you and say, hey, Josh, I want your services versus these 2,000 other, you know, companies out in the street here? In other words, what's your market differentiator in the eyes of your potential clients and prospects?
My wife calls me a drill sergeant sometimes. I guess the biggest differentiator is that we'll sit down and explain in terms that are not hard to understand. I'm a master of analogies, metaphors, and similes.
Right.
And we'll explain to them that here's why you need the following. Here are some folks you can talk to who understood that and came to work with us. Here are even some stories of people who, the successes, as you and I talked about, success stories. Here's a couple of people you can talk to who didn't do that. And they're still customers. We saved them. But here's what it costs. And sometimes it's necessary to explain. There's some really basic things that people can understand. I don't know that we work for anybody who's not entirely dependent on a computing infrastructure to perform their tasks. So we don't anymore, although once had a stonemason. We don't work for folks that have a 90% non-IT workforce. And there are companies where they have 300 employees and only 20 of them use the PCs. We don't have that kind of clientele. So it's pretty easy for me to explain to people that without your IT infrastructure, you're not making money. You're not working. That's easy. The next thing that's pretty easy to explain to them is that for every $1 million that you guys bill in a given year, your top line, assuming you are open about 250 days a year, which most U.S. businesses are, unless they're retail and they have weekends, but 250 days a year, 50 weeks times 5, round numbers, you're bringing in $4,000 a day for every million of top line. A typical customer is a few million at least, a couple of million. So they're going to lose 5 or 10 grand a day, period, for being down. That's an easy number for them to wrap their heads around. But then I explain to them, that's the hard costs. Then there's the unpredictables. If you're in a business where missing a deadline will cost you a customer, the next thing you have to ask yourself is, what's your average customer worth and what does it cost to replace them? And that typically exceeds the actual hard costs that we talked about of being down. But when it's all shook out, a typical business we support loses $10,000 or $20,000 a day of income and customer retention and goodwill or more. Those are big numbers. They're pretty easily established. They're not fancy. You don't need calculators. You don't need spreadsheets, and you don't need to persuade people about soft costs like employee time and lost productivity. They're very straightforward numbers. So I try to start with that and explain to people, this is critically important. I'm very straightforward. I'm extremely straight-spoken. I really don't have any problem explaining to folks that I've done this 30 years, 25 as NetSciences. I've worked with hundreds of businesses in several states, and I've spoken in dozens of states. I've written more than 100 times in my industry, and I really do have hands-on experience. And I understand where you can cut corners and where you can't. And I think that the ability to express that and the ability to relate to folks directly, and that usually means one-on-one, sitting in an office across a desk from somebody, is critically important. We also bring them in and let them see how well run our operations are, everything from a spotless, beautiful place to procedures for everything. And I think that the combination of experiencing that and probably speaking with our references, which are extremely good, I think that alone is enough to differentiate us. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. I mean, there are a lot of folks that they really don't see value, they see price. And I'm okay with that. We express to them many times, especially when I deliver a quote or a proposal, the final sentence in every one of them is, if you're reviewing several quotes and you find that ours is the lowest quote, let's talk, because it means we missed something. We will never be the cheapest option. And if we are, there's something wrong and we need to talk about it. And I know that's cheeky, but the reality is it's true. We look at everything. We talk about TCO. We project things out at 3, 4, or 5 years. Total cost, we talk about every aspect we can, right down to replacement supplies for products they don't even realize consume those supplies. We even talk about electrical costs, if that's something they want to discuss. We try to be very complete, and we try to get them to understand that I hate saying we're more than just a vendor, we're a partner, but the truth is, if we integrate well with them, it's truthful. They'll do better, they'll grow, and so will we. And that's where we want to go.
Boy, Josh, that's so refreshing to hear. It really is. I'm really happy to hear that. It's so refreshing. But anyway, now let's kind of transition the show here now to something that we've heard about, you know, ad nauseum here, is COVID-19. Now, what has really changed the most during this pandemic in terms of IT security and as it relates to the SMB? I know everybody's heard of Zoom bombing, phishing sites, and work from home issues, but in your eyes, is there anything different that's changed that nobody else really has picked up on?
Yeah, there's a large number of things that have changed, but I'm going to focus on two or three of them. The very first thing that changed is we largely obliterated what most of us used to consider the IT security perimeter. Whether or not we called it that, we were comfortable with the idea that there was a perimeter. There was a firewall at the edge. There were people who worked outside of that through secure connections back into that or to cloud-based locations securely, but there was effectively a perimeter. That's largely over. As a matter of fact, several of our sites now have more people outside that perimeter, most of our sites, than inside. People are working remotely. They're working from anywhere, which is even harder than remotely. It is possible to secure a home network. It's not possible to secure fully somebody who moves at will and works from anywhere. The other thing that's changed dramatically is that I think 3.5 months ago, every machine that connected to one of our networks from outside the walls was managed by us and secured with a set of tools and processes and services on it. Actually, I can think of one exception. That's long past. Like, we have at least 100 what I call tangos, unknown threats. These are home user machines that would never have any business connecting to our networks and didn't 4 months ago, 3 months ago, and now they are. As a matter of fact, it might be the only time in my career, that I have not done security assessments first before connecting remote machines, that we haven't insisted upon fully managed endpoints simply because we couldn't. These companies who were suddenly working remote were also threatened with a loss of income on a scale that virtually none of them have ever seen before. I surely haven't. And with uncertainty at a level just like that. We don't know what 3 months and 6 months will be like. So it just wasn't something I was going to get away with doing. I wasn't going to be able to call each site and say, hey, we're not going to let you connect until we come out. For one thing, we couldn't send people into people's homes. So that was a big, big change as well. And finally, the third thing is, I'm sure you've heard the phrase, the weakest link is the nut that holds the wheel. Our end users, everybody's end users, everybody's staff, employees, even our own MSP staff, the biggest risk is compromised that way. And I don't mean maliciously. I mean that people make mistakes. Those numbers or those pressures are greater than they've ever been. There's so many more remote workers in so many compromised situations, and I mean things like being at home with your four children suddenly all day, suddenly realizing how underpaid public school teachers are throughout the United States, suddenly realizing what a challenge it is to keep even one young mind busy all day long, much less a handful. It's really, really something. And people who are now stay-at-home parents, or the luckiest of them are stay-at-home parents and stay-at-home workers, have these conflicting interests and great pressures. They also have the psychological stress that everybody's feeling, whether they're worried about disease themselves or those of their loved ones, or have people battling with that, or lost people, or the stresses I mentioned with their children, or even the difficulty we all experienced in the United States to secure toilet paper 2 months ago. All these little things add up, and they create a background level of noise driven by the stresses. Well, the noisier the head gets, the easier it is to make mistakes. And you can bet that the folks that make their living thieving over the internet were well aware of this. Recently, I was asked by one of the integrator mags, why are so many criminals targeting COVID-19 for their scams? And it's the Willie Horton answer, because it's where the money is. People realize that the bad actors realize that people under stress make more bad decisions, and they can be tricked. Many of our customers had no procedures whatsoever for a lot of things like the CEO wire fraud we hear about all the time. Send $178,000 to this bank in Moldova. And ironically, that was a real story. We almost had somebody do that. And ultimately, she acknowledged the fact that they don't do business in Moldova. They don't have anybody traveling there, and she doesn't know what Moldova is. But that kind of fraud has also ticked up quite a bit now. There's all kinds of clever stuff going on that drags people into making poor decisions. So the dissolution of the perimeter, the loss of control of endpoints, and the extra stresses and mistakes that end users are subject to now are all very deleterious to the overall security posture of these businesses. And it's really challenging. It is exceptionally challenging. We are still going through how we're addressing this. I don't think that as a nation we yet know what August, September, and October will look like in terms of COVID-19, work from home, or having work. So we're still day-to-day formulating better answers and trying to remember that everybody is under these stresses. And the last thing I want to do is pick up a phone and tell somebody, you have to buy this. You need to do this. You need to do this more expensive thing. So that's the real challenge. It's not that we can't secure these endpoints, train these users, and manage the expanded perimeter. It's how to do it with minimal change and minimal cost. And that's an endless challenge.
Okay. Now, the concept of perimeter security, I think from what I've been picking up, is it's basically going to be gone, or if it's already gone. I think corporate America is now adopting, or slowly will adopt, the concept of zero trust and more protecting endpoints than anything else. What are your thoughts on that?
Zero trust is one of those wonderful ideas. I always immediately think of libertarianism. I was a libertarian, at least I thought I was, in my 20s, maybe even into my 30s. I studied it in school, and I have a philosophy degree and read from Ayn Rand across the entire spectrum. The problem with libertarianism is it only thrives when everyone behaves well. And there are very few societies that I can safely say that of. Zero trust works very well when everyone can't be trusted to behave well, but it does require a phenomenal amount of preparation and attention to detail and ongoing attention to issues that pop up. It's almost the anti-MSP solution in the sense that it's a guaranteed way to annoy people and to vastly increase your ticket count. It's more of a concept than a deliverable in the SMB space at this point. And I would love to see it happen. Now, there are things that eat away at the edge of zero trust. So, for example, whitelisting, which used to be only an enterprise thing 10 years ago. You just couldn't do that on an SMB scale. There are companies making whitelisting actually happen, whether it's in the limited sense of application control on a desktop to more aggressive network-wide or outside the perimeter ways to address that. And in a sense, MFA is an application of zero trust. Zero trust is, in my mind, is a misnomer. Zero trust is really earned trust. You have to demonstrate identity. And again, for example, identity and access management, again, not an SMB thing, except, now we can actually approach that. We have SMB solutions. We don't. I'm sorry. NetScience is not yet offering what I would strictly define as IAM, but we're getting there, and we're starting to move. Even the bigger players are starting to understand the SMB market, which is where 50% of people in the United States worked 3 months ago. I don't really know what the numbers are going to be like in June, but 50% of our businesses were small in the United States, and that's where people worked. And I should say 50% of the businesses were small. I don't know that 50% of people worked in small business. But those things are moving down. So to shorten all this, zero trust is a wonderful idea. It's an extremely difficult to implement idea, and it is really not yet an SMB answer. But as we stitch these offerings together, that actually is the end goal, is to make sure that every endpoint, every identity, every object has to demonstrate its trustworthiness to execute its task. But again, even at the smallest levels, I don't know how many other MSPs out there, especially when the Windows XP, Windows 7 days, decided that they wouldn't have any local admins on their machines, which is absolutely an aspect of zero trust. But there are so many vendors that do such a poor job of writing software that can behave and function without having local admin access that even those tiny little things, the first step, the baby steps to zero trust, can still be staggeringly difficult. And I will point out that's still true in Windows 10. It's better, and we're getting there. But sure, zero trust is a great idea. It's right up there with peace on earth.
That's how I look at it, too. I think it's great in theory, but I think it's going to be quite a long time really fully implemented, because I really don't think zero trust can be – I don't think it can ever really happen. But, you know, only time will tell, I guess. Now,
I want to point out that zero trust is it's a phrase, and it's a new buzz phrase.
Right.
But if you think about what it really means, it's more or less the antithesis of the entire TCP/IP stack. The entire TCP/IP protocol and the entire internet was built on the open trust concept. As a matter of fact, one of the first things I did in the DOE when we got on the internet was start reading research papers and articles and other things that were sitting around the internet at university, on university servers. I mean, if you knew GET and PUT and some FTP basics, you could grab a paper and read it. That's not a zero trust concept. I mean, that's why we're where we are, because our world is TCP/IP based, period. And TCP/IP is all trust based, almost entirely. So now we've added everything from IPsec to I don't even want to go down the rat hole of how email works, but we've added a great number of layers of security to that, but it's a lot like frosting on a cake. I mean, if the inside of the cake, the inside isn't going to taste any different no matter what you frost it with, and that's where we are. So zero trust is a big leap.
Right. Now, why has endpoint security been such a disregarded subject in cybersecurity? Because from what I've been reading the headlines, you know, CIOs, CISOs, they're always worried about protecting the lines of communication in between the endpoints. You know, like they're great saying, oh, we need a VPN, we need this RSA token, you know, we need cryptography, encryption. But when it comes to protecting the point of origination and point of destination for these network communications, there's no security. So why has it always been such a disregarded topic?
Wow. I was afraid you might stump me. So your question is not a technical question. It's a question about human behavior. And I don't really know the answer to that, Ravi. You know, any IT guy is eventually going to have to pull a Star Trek quote out of his, I'll call it head. So in the original series, in the movies, there was one that involved Khan, Nguyen Sinh, Ricardo Montalban's greatest role, I think. But he talked in one section about how technical advances were incremental and how you could improve the equipment, you could improve the technology and gain small and incremental advances in performance. But if you could improve man, the results, the improvements were almost unlimited. And I think that really what we haven't done is improved the end users. It is, and I shouldn't say end users, the people, right? We use that phrase, end users in IT or worse. The people are not understanding what's going on. I mean, I read this morning, and I need to find it again so I can attribute the source. The year 2021 they expect to see cyber pilfering, cyber crime is expected to hit worldwide $6 trillion in 2021.
Right.
I don't know what the future holds for the world GDP, but I can tell you that roughly last year, and maybe this year, no, not this year, but last year, world GDP was around $6 trillion. I think it was 78. That puts cybercrime at a significant percentage, approaching double digits, of the GDP of the world. $6 trillion is also a larger GDP than all but the top 5 or 10 countries in the world. And if you think about it a little bit, $6 trillion leaves you plenty of room for, oh, I don't know, is that 6 million millionaires at cybercrime, or 6,000 billionaires, everybody else sharing the rest. That's just beyond imagination. That kind of adversary is not the kind of thing that most people understand. This isn't going to get better, at least not soon. And on top of that, people still click things. People still open attachments. I watched a user while we were helping them just a few weeks ago. He got a notification from the Australian, or Bank of Australia, I think. It was a fake message. It was a phishing attempt message, part of our training. But it was an Australian bank notifying him that a deposit into his bank account in Iceland had failed. He has nothing to do with Australia or Iceland. He knows both of those things. And he was about to click on that to see what was going on. As long as people continue to behave that way, I think endpoint security is almost moot. So I'm going to answer it two ways. The first is we need to work on the people first. But the second answer is that endpoint security is the hardest part. Securing the infrastructure and the servers and even the ingress and possibly the egress of these networks is just plain easier for the most part than securing the endpoints, because the endpoints are attached to the nuts that hold the wheel. They're the people. So I don't know that we really have ignored endpoint security. I think there's a phenomenal variety of approaches to it. I just don't know that we can succeed until we work on the people.
Well, now, one of the big issues of COVID has been, you know, the remote access, you know, having a uniform set of standards, trying to make things secure and safe, and there's always fear that, you know, employees are just going to bring their own device. You know, they're not going to use company-issued laptops or smartphones. You know, that's the, you know, the BYOD phenomenon. What do you do to provide remote access to your clients and to sites that you work at?
Well, this is ACBC. I mean, there's before COVID, and we basically mandated that every user that connected remotely had a managed device, whether it was a home machine we managed, at a lighter managed service. We have a low-end tier that doesn't include help desk services, just automated security, patching, and various other things, or a portable that was provided by the business. And we were very successful over time at getting everyone to respect that. So that was BC, and now it's AC after COVID. And reality is that there's just a there's at least 100 machines we know virtually nothing about. I mean, we know they were OS. We made sure that nobody connected that wasn't running the last few versions of Mac OS or Windows 10. But that's almost the extent that we know about these machines. So we approached it a different way. We decided, because there's three ways to protect a remote connection. You protect the initiator, you know, that remote machine. You protect the connection itself. You protect the target, which is the machine inside the office they're connecting to. I made the tactical decision that it was a losing battle to quickly and expensively protect the origination machine. So we decided to use a more secure methodology of connection and protect that connection. And we decided to further harden the target machines that they were connecting to. So we did that by proxied RDS, with a few exceptions, rather than a simple VPN client. And we did that by hardening the target machine even further. We were already a Cylance shop in terms of endpoint protection. And a SOC that we used, port that was a company called Solutions Granted out of Virginia, and they are wonderful folks to work with, great for MSPs. And right as this started to happen, they stepped up the offering and they added the ability at an almost zero cost, incredibly small cost we could absorb per endpoint. We added an InfoCite, InfoCyte. They had a slimmed down version of an InfoCite client, which is essentially a threat hunting and response client that sits in concert with the Cylance endpoint or EDR client. Those work together, and if there is detection of malicious activity on that endpoint, the target machine in the offices, the SOC through SG, Solutions Granted, will lock that machine down to where its communications can happen only between the endpoint and the SOC. And they will use that. They will step in, remediate the attack on that machine, or leave it locked out of the network. So that prevents lateral movement, which is effectively how ransomware moves around, or many other attacks move around a network. So that gave us a little bit of extra sleep at night. I mean, that's a big step forward. But the reality is we can't be comprehensive. We don't yet have effective origination remote machine management, partly because that's a sudden cost that's not trivial and it will truly scare people in these times, and partly because it's impractical. I mean, here is a true story. The first remote connection we set up with TrueGrid RDS and, you know, got into their network was the machine of a CEO of one of our two largest clients, and it was 14 years old, and it had been upgraded from Windows XP to Windows 7 to Windows 10 by somebody. He wasn't sure. That is not reassuring as an IT security guy. And the problem is that if you dive in, and even if you just throw an EDR client and maybe a DNS filtering agent on that machine, everything that goes wrong from there forward, you own. I mean, maybe right down to a failed hard drive. If there's a 14-year-old machine, well, you worked on it last month, and now the hard drive's dead. I didn't want to trigger those kinds of issues while people were struggling with the economics and the fear and the stresses of COVID. I might be overstating the case, but I don't think so. I really think that those problems were going to be big, and we decided not to step into it. And it was tactical. We could, that may be a bad call. That may come back to bite me. It has been a while, and at least it wasn't an immediately bad call. I can say that. But as time moves, or as we go forward, the next trick is to figure out how to express to people now it's time to armor up. Here, over the month of June, we're going to talk to people about who's going to stay remote, who's going to come back to the office, what's going to happen if we revert and we have more people moving remotely again because of what I hope doesn't happen, but another resurgence. And we have to figure that out. And it's an ongoing process. So once again, I don't have an easy, simple answer. I can only say we're in process. We're figuring it out.
Excellent. Now, what have you done in terms of further enhancing the IT security or cybersecurity for the SMB space?
Are we talking, when you say further enhancing, are you referring to BC, I'm sorry, after COVID, AC, or are you saying overall
in
our practice?
Do you think after COVID now that, things are starting to open up, hopefully, and hopefully we won't see a resurgence, what do you think the next steps are to enhance the IT security for the S&P? Because obviously everybody's on a shoestring budget right now, where he's trying to conserve cash flow, so S&Ps are going to say, although they're cognizant of the fact that cyber is a very important thing, but they're going to say, hey, we still don't have the money to do this right now. What can be done for free? So what's the next logical step?
I'm going to fudge my answer to this just a little bit, because I'm going to talk about things that we just started doing in January. Now, I had planned to do this before COVID struck, but these were enhancements to basic IT security that we were able to roll together at very little to no cost for our sites. We have three levels of plans. On our middle and upper level plans, there was no additional cost. And those two things were internal vulnerability scanning, which is not quite as simple as it sounds. So it does everything from look for missing patches or deprecated protocols to default username and passwords on IoT devices or any devices for that matter, including where we found them on our cameras, our surveillance cameras, to new device alerting. So that's all one device provided by a company called IGI. The service is called Nodeware. And that cost is so inconsequential that we were able to just roll that in for free. We also added an enhanced firewall log reading and response service. There's at least a half a dozen players in the SMB space that do firewall log reading. And many of them will do alerting, but the response that we're getting out of a company called Dark Cubed is the best that I'm aware of. And what I mean by that is if they detect a genuine human-driven threat, so not a port scan and not automated stuff, but an advanced persistent threat, they'll identify an origination IP or block of IP addresses, publish that block, and firewalls, and I know SonicWall, I believe Sophos Fortinet and others will pick these up. They'll pick that published list up and import it into the firewall in near real time. So if there's an attack coming from a subnet in Belarus or China or Israel or Brazil or the United States for that matter, that block gets published as a known bad actor, the same way that botnet blocks get published, and that gets imported into the firewall, and the firewall blocks all attempts to connect from that block. That whole process can happen in a few minutes to an hour in the middle of the night without anything but an alert that we see the next day or a notification, not alert. So that is another very major step forward that we didn't have before, but we've now rolled that, again, without charge, into our middle and upper range plans. We roll those two services together along with the remote access and encryption service I talked about earlier through TrueGrid, and drop those at $300 per site for people on our lowest end plans. But people on the middle or upper range plans get all of that included in the plan. So arguably that makes me less profitable in the short term, but the calculation is there's so much payback in terms of goodwill and protection, because the loss that a client can have or the reputational loss we might suffer if there's a really severe breach is just so much greater. It's really the same thing we tell people when we price our services. When they ask, how could it be worth that to secure your business, you just ask them, what's the business worth? What are you going to do? Do you plan to retire someday? Where will that money come from? Do you care about your reputation? What about your clients? So I figure what's good for them is good for us. I sell them on us being able to secure their operations. I place these services without extra cost for most sites because I know that they go further towards actually achieving the goal that I've stated, which is keep them secure, and they protect against immense risk at very little cost. So, I mean, we're talking about less than triple digits a month for both of those services. So that's really fantastic. We have all this capability at such low cost that we can roll it into any reasonably priced plan.
Yeah, excellent. As I said, businesses are opening up, and hopefully, we'll get back to some normalcy here. There's going to be a new normal post-COVID ID. Now, what will this new normal look like for your clients? And how will you help them, and how will you help them secure that new reality? What, do you have a plan of attack for that, or like you're just going to kind of take it day by day and see what happens, or because the situation is so fluid right now?
Well, I'm not positive I'm divining exactly the nature of the question, but stop me if I'm wrong. I think what you're asking me is, as people, what do we see as the near future as people return to or approach a return to normality in terms of business operations, and how does that affect their IT security profile? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, because see, what's normal before COVID is probably never going to happen again, or it could. But there's going to be a new normal now, and, you know, there's, and I guess that's going to be the working from home now. You know, you're going to see a lot of businesses, you know, not even having a physical, you know, like a brick-and-mortar presence, everything's not going to be virtual. So is this what your clients, is this what you see that your clients are going to be doing more virtual work, and how do you secure that new normal?
So, yes, I do see that what's very likely to happen is that the new normal is going to be more hybrid. There's going to be at least some people from most sites working remotely as a regular thing. Even in my own crew, I expect to rotate out one remote worker per day or week or pay period. We haven't really worked through that yet. So that's absolutely going to happen. I think I alluded earlier to the fact that we're starting to approach this subject with people in June and talk about the fact that all devices, all routes into the network must be secured. I'm hopeful that that will ultimately lead to the business-purchased, business-quality products being in their homes. And we won't have any 14-year-old twice-upgraded machines that would all be running new, secure, patchable devices. One of the horrors of IT is that as these threats have evolved, it's no longer good enough to patch just the operating system and applications that ride on top of it. There are now attacks at the device level, whether they're things like AMT attacks that take advantage of remote management capabilities in Intel chipsets, or side channel CPU attacks, and various others now, where patching the hardware has to be done. And most vendors, Intel in particular, have decided they're not going to provide patches for older machines, and they seem to defy that line that makes them older is somewhere between 5 and 7 years. So I can't even secure the hardware on a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 14-year-old machine. And there is a lot of machines. There are a lot of machines out there at that age. A lot of our clients think that giving away obsolete machines to their staff is a good thing. So their staff take home 8-year-old Windows XP machines and 7-year-old Windows 7 machines, and they don't realize that that's actually not a kindness. I believe that it may be better than having no computer, and there are plenty of people without computers that receive them, but I can't patch those machines. Mm-hmm. I could ignore that at some point because they weren't a real threat to the secure networks, but now those are the same machines that they're connecting into the network from. So, yeah, they've been upgraded to Windows 10. Some of them have been upgraded to Windows 10 with a $20 or $40 product key they bought over the Internet and so forth. There's a lot of unknown variables. So our goal in the next quarter, I'd say by the end of the summer, is to make sure that every endpoint that continues to connect to our networks is of professional grade or business grade, new enough to be fully patched, hardware and software, as managed, monitored, and secured. That's going to be a hard battle to win for a while. There are many businesses that will be struggling for a long time, and I have to find a way to let them know that this isn't something they can overlook. I don't have the answer to how we're going to do that yet.
Okay, now as we kind of now come in the last part of our show here, I just kind of want to get your thoughts, you know, on the other, you know, security issues that are, you know, not COVID related. But one thing I want to ask about, like, does NetSciences do any work with the Internet of Things? You know, it's basically where everything's all connected together in both virtual and physical worlds. Honestly, I find the concept to be very scary. I don't have a smart home or a smart car. I mean, it just increased the attack service for the cyber attacker. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you have a smart home or smart car or anything like that?
So no, actually, I guess I have a smart TV. I don't have it plugged into the internet, so it's angry at me. I do have internet service coming through my, well, of course, through my cable box, and I believe into my Blu-ray player, and we can get to some streaming, which I only did a few months ago when my wife put her foot down and said, yeah, we're streaming. The and I don't, well, I have a car built in 2012, an Audi from 2012. Before this, BC, before COVID, I thought this might be a year I bought a new car. But I also didn't want to buy a fully connected smart car unless I was confident that I could fully disconnect and fully dumb it down. And I'm not confident. That's become very hard to do. The manufacturers have become very good at armoring them against consumer defeat. They're not nearly as good at armoring them against hijack, but they're very good at keeping away from making them unhijackable. So no, I don't have those things. We don't have a smart thermostat. I've got a smart wife, smart dogs, and pretty smart cats, but that's as far as we've gone in the whole smart home thing so far. I'm a little bit of a curmudgeon that way. I wear an analog watch. I drive a 6-speed. There's a lot of reasons that I'm not fully teched across my whole life, and they have to do with what you said, attack surfaces. If I don't need it and it's a risk, I don't do it. So that part, yeah, we're coming to complete agreement. And I want to point out that IoT, which I have always defined as the Internet of Threats, is scary. I mean, the biggest problem that I see is so many manufacturers rush to market and cheapen down their IoT connectivity that even once or sometimes immediately as these vulnerabilities are discovered, the devices aren't patchable. They are not designed for you to be able to patch and secure them ever. And these are IoT connectivity that's buried inside of 600-pound industrial refrigerators and $20,000 machines or 1,500 distributed devices such as LED light controls. There's all these things where they're never going to be patched. They will forever or for 10 or 20 years of their lifetime, which, by the way, is the lifetime of LED bulbs and refrigerators and various other things, they're going to be vulnerable. That is a horrifying thought to me. Maybe I'm just not smart enough, and maybe there's an answer that I don't grasp, but I haven't encountered it in the industry yet. Now, of course, we VLAN off those devices, and we can do some management and control. We can track their communications, and I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. But VLANing them off is like, you know, defending yourself against sharks by wearing thicker skin. I mean, it's just a slow, it's an initial first response, but it's not the answer to it. And I don't know what our answer is in this industry to the whole Internet of Threats issue. It is truly profound. Now, I wanted to talk about really quickly, I had an IoT device. I hadn't even thought of it as such, but I had an internet radio. So you can tune in radio stations from all over the world. In my life, I have spoken 10 languages, and I speak about 5 now, and I'm fascinated by, ever since I was a child, and collected stamps, and traveled all over the world now. I'm fascinated with the world and languages and culture and food and women and other things I can't say, but I love that stuff. So the internet radio is a natural for me. I could tune into radios from countries I haven't and probably will never visit and countries I want to go back to and just play. Brought it into work. I decided I'd have it in my office at work. The next day, our firewall lot folks got a hold of me and said, why are you sending encrypted traffic to China? I said, they locked it down to the IP. And, of course, it was the Wi-Fi IP assigned to this thing. It was on its own subnet, but I don't know what it was sending, and they don't know what it was sending. It was encrypted. So I sold it on eBay, and I did make a note that it was Chinese-made, and proceed, now buyer beware. And that's not a political statement. The reality is I don't know what it was doing. I have no idea why it was sending back telemetry or information to China. But the next week we got a call And once again, we went to a site or called the site and said, hey, we have a new IP address. And this is before we had a device that would alert us to new MAC addresses. But these guys said, hey, there's an IP address sending encrypted data to China. So we called them two or three times. Of course, they're, I don't know, we didn't add anything. So I had to drive over there, and I found an industrial refrigerator plugged into an Ethernet jack. And I asked them why it was plugged into their network. And they said they had no idea. They don't know who did it or why it was done. So, of course, I went to the switch end and unconnected it, and I went and took the patch cord out of the refrigerator. And the next day we got a call, and somebody else had gone back and plugged it back in. So then we blocked the MAC address and physically blocked the port on the drop by the refrigerator. But it was sending encrypted data to China. Now, it might have been diagnostics. It might have been phoning home and saying, everything's fine. It might have been part of the ability, I mean, there are shelves in that thing where you can assign areas and weights, and that the refrigerator can tell you when you're running low on butter if it happens to know how much butter is where and what constitutes low, things like that. I don't know, and I don't want to assign ill will to it, but it's spooky to think that these devices are sending data back, phoning home, without your knowledge. And yet, the reality is, that's the reality. So I'm scared of IoT. But I think that at this point, until they become so intertwined, I mean, until we're truly wearing IoT all the time and interacting with it with AR and VR on an ongoing basis, I think it's the risks are controllable. I'm hopeful that manufacturers will get that they can't put devices out that can never be secured, but I'm only somewhat hopeful. I'm not even sure that auto manufacturers are ever going to get to that point, and I'm sure if you spend some time searching in your favorite engine, looking for examples of it, you'll see that cars can be hacked at levels that'll just shock you from great distances by limitedly skillful people with free tools. That's not a good thing.
Right. Now, another one is the area of artificial intelligence. Have you done any work with that, with NetSciences? What are your thoughts on using AI, like, for automation in cyber, you know, like when it comes to, you know, helping filter out for, you know, false positives, helping automate the more mundane tasks of pen testing and threat hunting?
Well, AI is a very broad thing, and, of course, we've been talking about it for 20, 30 years. The real applications of it, or most of the real applications in IT, are really a subset known as machine learning. And that's a very powerful tool. As a matter of fact, almost anybody that reads and filters logs in devices, whether they're firewalls, domain controllers, switches, routers, there's some level of AI or ML machine learning being done there. Nobody can actually scan all the packets or read all the lines in a log or analyze all the packets in a capture. There's some degree of automated recognition being done. NetSciences doesn't have a specific AI or machine learning remit at this point, but we do work with vendors, and in particular two different outsourced SOCs for endpoints and for firewall logs, and they are absolutely reliant on machine learning and AI type algorithms to separate the wheat from the chaff so that they bring to human eyes what appears to be actual activity and not just automated port scans and various other things, fingerprinting and whatever else goes on. What I'm a little concerned about is that, once again, a Willie Horton thing, it's where the money is. Bad actors have really good machine learning capabilities too. They can rent supercomputer time, or they can build their own render farm. They can do whatever they need, or their own Beowulf cluster. They can do whatever they need to harness machine learning algorithms to build attacks that evade machine learning algorithms detection. Or to, I think maybe the next really big frontier, or the current really big frontier, is to assemble all the disparate social engineered data that they collect to more precisely spearfish. I mean, we have phishing, we have spearfishing. I don't know if we have any laser spearfishing, but that's where we're going. When people have access to, when bad actors have access to so much data on so many people, and they can construct everything from, you know, their pets' names for the last 25 years to their political preferences to, you know, what what gender underwear they like to wear, when they can construct those things and build really clever, focused attacks, we're up against yet another higher threshold of threat. And I think that machine learning is also part of the problem. It's great for building defenses, but everything we know how to use to defend ourselves can be used to attack us. And my concern is that that's happening at a faster and more effective rate than defense.
Okay. Now, another thing I want to ask you about in cyber is, and, you know, being an MSP and all that, is cybersecurity insurance policies. Have your clients ever asked you about that? Like, especially for the SMB, your SMB clients, have they ever asked you about that? Have you ever provided guidance or consulting in that, on the topic?
Yes. It's funny. It's a little bit like the folks that find a new building and move and then ask me if they can get internet access, which has many times happened, and at least twice. Albuquerque's funny. There are office parks that don't have high-speed internet still, or all they have is DSL, which I do not define as high-speed internet. It's still there. And it's not just Albuquerque. We might be the biggest city in the United States to suffer from that, but there are plenty of cities in the 1 to 300,000 person range, especially in the rural south and western United States. There's poorly served areas for internet. This is a little like that. Some of my clients will call me and they'll say, hey, I just applied for cyber liability insurance. Would you look at this document? And I'll look at it. And almost without exception, they'll have just said yes to everything. And 90% of it, or 75% of it, or 60% of it isn't true. No, you don't have a chief privacy officer. No, you do not review the logs of all these devices on a daily basis. No, you do not have an incident response plan in place. Now, in the last year, I've moved virtually everybody we have to our middle or higher end service, and they can start saying yes to those things because we've virtualized that. That VCIO that you talked about an hour ago is the preparation of tailored incident response plans, disaster recovery plans, policies, acceptable use policies, bring your own device, or bring your own death plans, all these different things that we'll create for them. More of them can say yes now. And a few clients have come to us first and said, wow, what is all this and how do I do it? We're up against a few problems here. First of all, it's not clear that a policy costs any more to a business based on how they respond to those questions. None of the agents I've talked to, insurance agents, can answer that question for me definitively. We know that the annual turnover, annual top-line revenue of the business matters, and we know the amount of coverage they want matters, and we know their industry matters. We don't know if their security profile really matters to the pricing of their coverage. That's the first problem. The second problem is that we also don't know what claims – nobody's had a claim yet amongst our clientele, and virtually nobody I know of has. So we don't know what the claims response or coverage – are they going to pay out? And, you know, if somebody makes an $11,000 claim, that's probably going to be treated a lot different from somebody who makes a $600,000 claim, even if they both have $2 million policies. So what's the diligence that they're going to perform at the point of where they're going to probably have to pay that claim? What are they going to do? Are they going to say, sure, no problem, or are they going to come out there and say, okay, I want to see the logs. I want to talk to the people. I want to see your response plans. I want to talk to the people that manage. What's going to happen? That's a big question, too. And the third and biggest problem is that I can't get answers to these. And being the marketing genius that I am not, about 16 months ago, it occurred to me, or 18 months ago, I ought to ride around with the people that sell these policies, and I ought to be the guy that, when they try to sell these policies, talks to these small businesses and says, oh, well, what are you doing for, fill in the blank? That didn't work because, I did a couple ride-alongs, but the agents pretty quickly realized that I was going to prevent them from closing deals because virtually none of these small businesses did have these policies, processes, procedures in place. So they were going to be discouraged, and instead of addressing the problem, which was the lack of policies, processes, and procedures, they were going to just not buy insurance. I don't know where to go with all this. We do have, that I know of, half our sites probably now have cyber. And, of course, we've had cyber in E&O for years. But I don't know what their experience is going to be when it comes to payout. Nor do I even know what sort of diligence those agents or, I guess, adjusters will perform and what sort of proof they'll need from us if there's a claim. So this is yet another dimension of uncertainty that we stepped into. None of this has been affected by COVID, but I do fear that as people start cutting costs, I'm very hopeful that IT support will be at the bottom of the list, but I'm not nearly so hopeful that insurance coverages will be. So that's another threat. Even those that do have it may let it lapse.
Yeah, in fact, I just signed a book proposal, I think, a few months ago. I'm going to be writing a whole dedicated book just on cybersecurity and insurance policies and how it's not really claimed to be what it really is, because I think a lot of SMB owners, they get blindsided. They say, oh, yeah, I've got cybersecurity insurance. I'm going to be protected. But there's a lot that goes behind it that they're not really quite aware of. And so that's the idea of that book, is to make the SMB owner aware of what's, you know, really going to happen, because I think a lot of insurance companies require that you meet certain standards before you can get a coverage policy. Then they can audit you after the fact also to make sure you're up to snuff. And even if you do file a claim, I mean, it's kind of like health insurance. There's no guarantee you're 100% covered with that. So,
well,
you know.
You said, I mean, I don't know that I've seen anybody, again, I'm only watching agents interact with people or seeing forms that people fill out, but I don't think they're doing the front-end work. I don't think they are explaining to people that they have to substantiate the answers they're providing. One of our clients fully, accurately answered dozens of questions, which meant he had to say, no, we don't have that, to a third at least of them. And he got the same coverage at the same cost of one of our clients who filled it out and honestly lied about a lot of it. So they got the same coverage at the same cost. They were in different industries, as a matter of fact, so extra variables there. But I don't really know what they're doing to evaluate those forms, and I don't know how they're going to behave when claims get made. So it's hard to know. I mean, there's just so little loss and coverage experience yet. This is yet another time where, you know, the technology is out ahead of law and practice. So I don't know what this is going to pan out to be. I am very interested in seeing my clientele get this coverage, but quite honestly, I don't feel comfortable telling them that this is going to pay out. First of all, it's not my field, and I'm not an insurance agent. I wouldn't play one on TV. But I don't know how to approach this other than sit with them and work through what they need to do to be able to say yes all the way across. And some of them now can. Many of them almost can. Nor can I even tell them you have to, or what will happen if you can't, or what will happen if you're deceptive, or what will happen if you do say yes to every question and you can prove that. Will you be paid? What will the carve-outs be? You know, what if there's a nationwide attack under the auspices of an emergency action alert from the U.S. government that's actually phishing and it encrypts 10 million machines? Will they pay out? I don't know. Do you know?
No, I don't have the answer to that. I wish I did, but yeah, there's just no guarantee anything. But anyway, as we wrap up our show now, Josh, there's one final question. I'll probably keep this, as I always say, the best for last. Now, every business, SMB, individuals, we all are at risk for being a victim of cyber attack. The key is how to mitigate that risk. If it does happen, how do we be proactive so that we contain the damage? What do you – what I'm trying to get at, suppose you meet one of your clients, and like your grocery shopping and or whatever, you know, and they say, hey, Joshua, yes, what do you recommend to me to protect myself? What do I do to protect my family? Do you have like a laundry list of items that you can just tell off the top of your head what they should do, or how do you approach that?
Well, I try not to have those conversations. I mean, honestly, it's a lot of professional folks deal with that. I mean, I watch doctors. Somebody finds out they're a doctor sitting next to them on a plane and they want to talk about a pain in their foot for 40 minutes. And I watch attorneys field questions about intellectual property or patent registration or inheritance or blind trusts or whatever. And I watch the same pain cross their faces, crosses mine when somebody says, well, how do I protect my home machine? The reality is nobody can. The threats to the home user are so much more sophisticated than they can fully protect against that I try not to make people believe that it can be safe. Now, I do tell them that I remind them that if you're camping with your friend and a bear attacks, as long as they're not a good friend or a wife, you don't really have to outrun the bear. You have to outrun the friend. And what I mean by that is that attacks are generally promulgated against easier targets. People break into homes without alarm systems and bars or even good closures or through hidden areas so they can't be seen. And people attack, they perform cyber attacks on randomly harvested, easily identified and penetrated targets. So try not to be one of them is the first step. And that means top-tier endpoint protection that's more than just antivirus. Antivirus, web filtering, I don't know if we can call it EDR for standalone solutions for end users yet in the home, but it's getting there. And I talk to them about sophisticated software like that. I talk to them about weekly checkups to make sure that they're patching all of their software. Some things are automated, some aren't. I talk to them about using DNS filtering, whether it's built into their endpoint protection or filtering, running all their DNS traffic through a clean DNS provider that's free to the end user like Quad9 and others. Those are all important things. But mostly, as I said earlier, I give them the whole Ricardo Montalban Kahneman Singh thing about improving themselves. Because everything they do, I mean, I could drop a $10,000 firewall in their home and have them spend $500 a month to protect the machine, and they can break that. Their behavior is the single most important factor. It's not good enough alone, but it's the one thing they can't overlook.
Okay. Well, Joshua, we thank you for your time this afternoon. We really appreciate your time. I think you gave a lot of good insights, especially as it relates to the SMBs. That's a fair area of mine to talk about, their SMBs, because they really, I think, need a lot of guidance with cybersecurity. And I think that's going to be the next, that's one of the, prized, I guess, jewels or the crosshairs of cyber tech. I think SMBs really need our help and educate them to really how to protect themselves down the road here, especially post-COVID. So thanks once again for your time, and we hope to have you again on a future show.
Thank you very much, Robbie. It was great. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I know it's my tendency, but
no.
I appreciate your reining me in occasionally. All right. Well, thank you.
You gave some really powerful insights, which other guests haven't done, so we really appreciate that for our audience.
Well, thank you. All right. Well, I will say I'll close with my after COVID, my new tagline, just stay positive, Robbie, just don't test positive. Carry on.
That's a great. Hey, talking about trademark registration, you should get that registered as a trademark then, huh?
Yeah, maybe. I say it. I don't know.
I know
if that's really what I want to be known by, but that is my favorite phrase of the month. All right. Well, carry on, buddy.
Great. Help you. All right. Take care. Bye.